I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemian podcast.
And tonight's show comes to us from a listener, Steve C. Thank you very much for the recommendation. This is actually a great one, and he sent me a PDF that was something like 140 pages long, and it was an amazing read. This guy is super fascinating. Who we're talking about today is Cornelis Jacobsen Drebbel, and he's a kind of a Edison of his time. He's like this crazy inventor way ahead of his time, and in some ways he actually stands alone in the 17th century, I would say, from reading some of these stories. We're talking the Golden Age of Alchemy, and even compared to the other guys out there, this guy has an amazing story to tell. So I'm really excited that someone sent this to me, and I got to hear about it. And he's Dutch. Some of the highlights we're going to talk about here is he's Dutch, which is weird. He moved to England. He lived in England. He served in King James's court. He moved to Prague and served what?
You know who.
You thought we weren't going to say it this episode, did you?
No, it's going to happen.
No, he was in Rudolf II's court. That is actually a really interesting story, even among people in Rudolf II's court.
Well, yeah, think about the CV. If you had a CV out there for your alchemical sort of background, you want to have be in the court of Rudolf II. It's got to be some good creds right there.
Yeah, he has an interesting story there. He was into optics in a really amazing way. Then obviously we wouldn't be talking about it if he wasn't into chemistry and alchemy and that sort of thing. And he kind of built the first navigable submarine in 1620. And it's actually cooler than that even sounds. So there's that coming. And then what got my nerd senses tingling, should I say that? Should I not?
Just spidey senses. It works the same thing.
he was into measurement and sort of control systems. That was a really interesting read. So this is actually what got him the different monarchs' attention was because he had some amazing ways of controlling all sorts of stuff, pressure and temperature and all kinds of stuff. Then optics and chemistry, like I said. We'll kind of break down his life a little bit. So basically he lived from 1572 to the 7th of November 1633. So again, just classic golden age of alchemy here. And Cornelis Drebbel was born in Alkmaar, which is in Holland, and to an Anabaptist family. And the Anabaptist part is also kind of interesting, just to kind of round out his character and read about him. It is interesting that there's one quote I have here. I guess I'll just read this quote here. So it says, quote, "He lives according to the laws of nature and believes in nothing. He would not consider himself insulted by the action or word of another in connection with anything that might be done to him. If anyone abuses him, he answers not a word, unless they are right and are decent folk, and he does not exile himself in the very least. He carries no sword, neither in the country nor in town, and he would not defend himself were he attacked, although he is powerful and strongly built." And then there's other descriptions of his very modest dress, almost kind of grungy looking. And, mind you, he's in royal courts. And he's very humble, very didn't carry a sword in a time where everybody did.
He would have stood out pretty.
Yeah, I think so.
And we've talked about Anabaptists on this show as well as on the Bohemian podcast. And they were a very unique bunch of what we call later medieval hippies.
Yeah. I remember we mentioned the Münster Uprising a few times, when we talked about Faust. And yeah, that's kind of interesting. So yeah, really humble, kind of a pacifist in many ways. Although, as we'll later talk about, he did create some crazy weapons that were, sci-fi for the day, I guess. But in any case, after some years at a Latin school in Alkmaar, he attended the academy in Haarlem, also in North Holland, not the other Haarlem. And His teachers at the academy were Hendrik Goltzius, who's an engraver, painter, alchemist, and humanist. I might do a show on him. He's also a really interesting person. And then there's Cornelisun of Haarlem, and he's none other than the inventor of the wind-powered sawmill, which is
very Dutch.
Very Dutch, yeah. So,
well, Travis, he also kind of flew it around the same circles as some of the famous names we know well in this podcast, yeah. Right? So Francis Bacon from 1561 to 1628 was his lifetime, and that he was, of course, a mathematician. Henry Briggs, then there were some medical men who were busily making alchemical experiments, such as Robert Fludd, Raphael Thorius, Joachim Morsius, from 1593 to 1642 was his lifespan, and the translator and editor of Drebbel's works.
Yeah. In fact, well, we've done a show on Francis Bacon, Robert Fludd, or at least they're on the list, I don't know. And then I was thinking about Joachim Morsius, too, because he's also an interesting character. It's just golden age of alchemy. Like, that's kind of the point I'm trying to make here, that he had really interesting contemporaries, and he knew a lot of them personally. When I was talking about his dress, so the secretary of the Duke of Württemberg, Wurmser von Mendenheim, writes in 1609, "His Royal Highness went to the park in Eltham to see the Perpetuum Mobile." That's a perpetual motion machine, which I'll get back to later. That's kind of what his claim to fame, really. "The inventor's name is Cornelis Drebbel, who was born in Alkmaar, a very light-haired and handsome man, and very gentle manners, altogether different from such like characters." As in, the average hoi polloi of the kind of charlatan alchemists and, you know.
Used car salesman.
Yeah, so he was like very humble, and he knew his stuff. Like, he was just a genius in many ways.
Constantine Huygens informs us that he looks like a Dutch farmer, all right? Yeah. His fair complexion and light hair, of course, and big build. Depresque gives us most of the details that we possess to this day. According to his own statement, he received from the Kufler brothers. And this was about the year 1627, Travis. So, quote unquote, "He is a man of good standing, sharp-witted, and full of ideas about great inventions. Returning to the life of the said Cornelis Drebbel, Kufler narrated that as his years increased, his inventions also increased. The latter welled up spontaneously out of his consciousness, without benefit from the reading of books, which he always despised," which is kind of interesting there, yeah. Isn't it? "Being firmly convinced that the truth and perfection of the sciences lay in the secrets of nature, in which that they are all concealed, and it is recalled that he had reached a considerable age before he could understand Latin or speak it, and that he even taught himself without anybody to teach him." Right. So when you say a self-made man, mm-hmm. This is who we're talking about. "He lives like a philosopher and is interested only in his observations. He despises all things of the world and also its great men, with he rather greet a poor man than one of worldly position. Drebbel behaves like a simple and ignorant person. When he is asked whether he can make this, that, or the other thing, he says that he cannot. He only shows his real self to persons he considers intelligent or to those who desire to become so. For 3 or 4 years, he has been smoking tobacco, a thing which he used to hate. He has become so much the slave of this habit that he spends most of his days and nights smoking, and declares that they who do not smoke have no sense. When he meets anyone..." So maybe the original Marlboro man, if you will. All right. "So when he meets anyone who is a hard smoker he respects, he likes him very much. And in such a case, he is able to explain his secrets, whereas otherwise he is very uncomfortable. The habit of smoking was introduced to England, of course, by Sir Walter Raleigh, actually in the court of Queen Elizabeth."
Yeah, we talked about that in the Elizabeth episode.
So you can see the nicotine habit started kicking in.
So he hated it at first, but then once he started smoking...
Hooked.
Apparently super addicted, but then also he wouldn't even talk to anybody unless they were also a smoker.
Right.
So I wonder if this guy had, like, I don't know, he's just a weird cat in general, just... all kinds of out there, but definitely a really smart man. It's kind of like a, you know, some sort of savant in some ways, but like weird social habits, you know.
Well, you
also very humble. Like, if someone says, "Can you build this or that?" He's like, "No, I can't. You know, no, I have no idea." But if he probably could.
At the beginning of this podcast, you mentioned him to something that most Americans around the world can understand in their history books as like a Thomas Alva Edison.
Yeah.
Right. I was thinking more like a Benjamin Franklin.
Also, yeah, absolutely.
But when you talk about his humbleness, that is not the traits of these other two men.
Yeah, so maybe
Franklin wasn't humble.
Yeah,
neither was Edison.
Not even. I'm also thinking Tesla, and that doesn't really apply.
Doesn't really work either. So he really was a man of his own.
Yep. Yeah. No. I mean, he's a really interesting character to research. So thanks again, Steve. But so basically, Drebbel has another skill, which he became a skilled engraver, and specifically on copperplate. And then, of course, he also had an interest in alchemy. And so to run through his life a little bit more. So in 1595, he married Sophia Jansdochter Goltzius, younger sister of Hendrik, and settled at Alkmaar. They had six children, of which four survived. I think two of them were stillbirths, if I remember correctly. And Drebbel worked initially as a painter, engraver, and cartographer. And he actually had a lot of skill. I mean, there was a bunch of stuff that I left out of the show just on his engravings, and some of them are still around today and quite famous. But he was in constant need of money because of his kind of, well, because of the prodigal lifestyle of his wife. I think we've heard that one before, too. Yep. In 1598, he obtained a patent for a water supply system and a sort of perpetual clockwork. I'll get back to those. And then in 1600, Drebbel was in Middelburg. Middelburg is in the northwest of Holland. I've been there several times. I don't remember much. Let me just leave it at that.
Oh. What?
So Drebbel was in Middelburg, where he built a fountain at the Noorderpoort. So Middelburg's a really cool town because I've been there three or four times. We have friends of the family that live there. And at his time, it was in the middle of an island, which is why it's called Middelburg. Now it's in the middle of a peninsula, which is much bigger.
Right.
Because
They drained all the waters.
Because that's what they do. You can actually drive to this. In his time, it was an island. You can drive there now, and it's much bigger than it used to be.
Actually, it's one of those places that you may want to take a day trip from Amsterdam. If you go to Amsterdam, go to
Middelburg. Oh, it's really cool.
You also can go to Haarlem. That's also a great day trip to go to as well. But these places were alive and well as centers of industry.
I was going to say, like, very industrious little towns at that time. So, in fact, that in Middelburg is where he met a maker of telescopes and learned to grind lenses for optics. And he wasn't just some average dude doing this. Like, he, you know, we'll get back to that later too. But he got into optics and started to, you know, in his nature, just kind of experiment and push the boundaries of it. And he created a magic lantern and a camera obscura, which are both sort of projectors. He took some of these mediums to its limit, and that's another thing that really impressed King James and also Rudolf II. So to the layman, this could almost seem like magic, because he could project a shape and make a bear turn into a pig, and, you know, just like all these just crazy things from light. And some of his friends in that field actually got reputations as magicians from the lay people, because it was just, you know, brand new technology at the time.
So around 1604, the Drebbel family moved to England, probably at the invitation of the new king, James I of England, or known as the Fourth of Scotland, right? He was accommodated at Alton Palace. Drebbel worked there as a mask, which we believe is some kind of performer at court.
Yeah.
It's some sort of entertainment. He was attached to the court of the young Renaissance crown prince, Henry. He astonished the court with his inventions, the perpetual mobile that we talked about, the automatic, the hydraulic organs, all these wonderful optical instruments we just mentioned. The Duke of Wurttemberg came to see him at work at Eltham, where he had instruments all set up for a while. So, you know, he really made an impression there in England, and that kind of is a great segue to the impression he'll make in the court of Rudolf II in Prague.
So that got him some attention. In fact, he got quite a bit of attention while in the court of King James. And some little-known historical figure heard of him, someone we've never really talked about before on the show, the famous Rudolf II, Holy Roman Emperor of Habsburg. He's a really interesting character. I know we've never talked about him before.
Never.
But
28 times on the Bohemian podcast, at least.
Yeah, so
we love the guy.
Yeah, I think he's on every show.
Yeah.
But so Drebbel's fame reached the Holy Roman Emperor's ears, and on October 1610, Drebbel and his family moved to Prague on the invitation of Emperor Rudolf II. And again, so we have a podcast on Rudolf II. I think it's like, is it over an hour?
We actually, on the Bohemian podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We broke it up into two. We broke it up into two episodes.
I think
and that was like maybe our second show ever. Two years ago.
I published it too, and I left it together. And I think it's it's
it was something we did in the very early days of our podcast.
So Rudolph II. Yeah. If you haven't heard that show, it's on both our feeds, Bohemican or History of Alchemy. Definitely go listen to that. It's great. He's our number one favorite character. Here again, Drebbel kind of demonstrates his inventions. Now this is a fun story. It's kind of a bad time to be in Rudolph's court because 1610 is when he got there. And 1611, Rudolph II was stripped of all effective power by his younger brother, Archduke Matthias, and Drebbel was imprisoned for about a year. So Matthias actually imprisoned everybody at Rudolph's court. And after Rudolph's death in 1612, Drebbel was then set free and went back to London. Now, that's the really short version of that story. It's really interesting. While he was in Prague, Guglielmo de Medici wrote a letter to Galilei, which I think both of those people you've heard of before, in which he informs him that a Fleming has come to Prague who is able to construct a perpetual mobile, so this perpetual motion machine. And originally, he was only supposed to stay in Prague for 6 months, but Rudolph II kept him there until his death. So we've heard about this before, like Rudolph II, if he likes you, he's never going to let you go. In fact, he imprisoned some alchemists. In Prague, he also worked on alchemical experiments, and he also worked for the German mint for the making of gold alloys, kind of, you know, furthering that piece of science along, let's say.
Archduke Matthias may have almost put him to death after Rudolph died, but was saved when someone told him, you know what, you're about to kill the greatest man in the world. Unquote. That's a direct quote there. He had invented the glass bulb, perpetual mobile, and when he showed him all this information, he had designed also the fountain below.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Archduke ordered Drebbel to be set free and granted an amnesty. And when this had been done, he proffered apologies for the bad treatment he had received because he was not known. But said that if he would be willing to render to him the services that had been rendered to the emperor and to complete that he had begun, he would double the reward the emperor had promised him originally. Drebbel answered that he very much appreciated his offer to take him to the service, but that was not the service of the King of England, without whose orders he could not undertake nothing, and who had asked him, when he left him, to let him know whether he agreed to remain in his service. The Archduke Matthew then sent an express messenger to England. But meanwhile, Drebbel was sent a request to the king, begging him not to give permission for him to stay any longer, but to say that, on the contrary, he was commanded to return, for he was too badly treated here to allow himself to be longer detained. When all this had been done by the King of England, the king promised the Archduke to send him back within 1 or 2 years to finish for him which he had begun. This little trick caused the Archduke to send him back to England in a fine carriage with a gift of $2,000. Official records show that the above-mentioned sum was in the reality, $600.
Yeah. A lot of Rudolph's and then also later Matthias's sums of money were just hugely exaggerated. We saw this too in the John Dee episode or something.
Well, to give an idea, Travis, to really sum up that little bit of story right there, he saw there was no hope, and the only way to get out...
he locked him up for a year.
And he's probably going to keep him for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Well, so the source I was reading actually kind of had it like this, that there was a guy that saw out of his window, he saw scaffolds being built, and he asked Matthias what the deal was with that, and Matthias said, I'm going to put all of Rudolph's court to death.
We're going to clean house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And... at this, the guy got really sad, and he's like, including, you're also going to put Cornelis Drebbel to death? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, and that's that quote. He says, well, you're about to kill the greatest man in the world.
Yeah.
And Matthias is like, what? And he says, yeah, he built that bulb over there. And the bulb, so we'll get to the perpetual motion machine in a minute, but that was the perpetual motion machine, which was renowned across Europe. And he's like, you're about to kill the maker of that, you know? And so Matthias was like, all right, so, you know, show me this thing. And then he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I almost killed you, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, come and work for me, and I'll double your wage, and I'll, you know, finish all the projects you... This is actually amazing. Finish all the projects that you started for Rudolph? Matthias wanted nothing to do with any of these, of Rudolph's alchemy or anything else. Drebbel was the exception. That should stand for something. Like, that should mean something.
It does, but if you're Drebbel, you're looking at the time's ticking. If you do one small step, your head's going to be in that noose again.
Yeah, so... Matthias sends a courier to England, and Drebbel sends another courier to the crown prince saying, when you get Matthias's letter, tell him no, because I want to come home. You know, just tell him sorry, but you can't. And so the crown prince did that. That's another thing. When John Dee sent emails to Elizabeth I, crickets. Yeah. You know, when Drebbel sends something to the crown prince, he replies right away like, oh, no, I'm sorry. We need him here. You know, we'll lend you him another in a year or two. But right now I need him at my court. Like, it's unbelievable, yeah. You know?
Lucky for him, yeah. Actually.
So according to Svatek and Gindley, these are two Bohemian historians, Drebbel was mixed up in a case of embezzlement of money and jewels belonging to the Museum and Treasury of Prague. And the crime was perpetrated by a gentleman in waiting named Rutsky. And soon after the death of Rudolf II, this Rutsky was imprisoned with a number of others, like I mentioned, and, of course, Cornelius Drebbel. Now, Rutsky committed suicide. Svatek and Grindley do not know what became of the others, but Drebbel was let go, like I mentioned, and it's not known if this is really true. So he might have just gotten mixed up with the wrong crowd, you know, because, like I said, he worked at the mint. So, you know, some money and jewels went missing, and he was one of the suspects. Really little is known about this accusation. So these two historians brought this up, but it's kind of... It's speculation to some degree. I mean, there's records there, and others were arrested and either committed suicide or killed or whatever. But yeah, it's hard to say how much of a part Drebbel actually played in this. So when he went back to England, unfortunately, his patron Henry had also died, and Drebbel was suddenly in financial trouble.
Now, we mentioned before that he had a big passion for optics, and this is where it brings us to this part of his life at this moment, that he manufactured his glass-grinding machine optical instruments and compound microscopes with two convex lenses, for which there was a constant demand. In 1622, Constantijn Huygens stayed as a diplomat for more than 1 year in England. It had been Cornelius that taught Constantijn Huygens the art of glass grinding. That's a kind of a big deal because Constantijn later on taught his son, the famous scientist and mathematician Christian Huygens.
Yeah. Who you may have heard of. He's kind of a big deal. And the English natural philosopher Robert Hooke may have learned the art of glass grinding from his acquaintance Johannes Kufla. Kufla is mentioned all the time, by the way, when talking about Drebbel, because Kufla is basically the son-in-law of Drebbel. So his expertise kind of spread. I mean, Robert Hooke is also, you know, obviously a known entity, and it's pretty interesting. And then, you know, just to kind of... We'll come back to his inventions and stuff, but to bring his life story to a close, sort of, towards the end of his life in 1633, Drebbel was involved in a plan to drain the fens around Cambridge. Also very Dutch, like water, drain it, you know. but yeah, so he had a really novel approach to water pumps, which was he built a fountain in Middleburg, which was very famous, and had a lot of kind of innovative ideas regarding pumps. And so this was also one of them. And then, you know, he tried to make money towards the end of his life. But at this point, he was very poor. This is like the last year of his life. And he was running an ale house in England. And he died in London that year. This is kind of interesting because his ale house was kind of successful just because of his name. Like, people would hear that he's the guy that invented the perpetual motion machine, that actually created a working one, or he's the guy that created a machine that had artificial ebbs and tides like the ocean. And so people would actually come by his bar, basically, just to kind of see him and get served beer by him. So it's pretty interesting. We have from the Rawlinson manuscript, we know that he was a brewer and an innkeeper. And here's a quote from that. He was very poor and in his later time kept an ale house below the London Bridge. He had an invention of going underwater, which he used so advantageously, that many persons were persuaded that he was some strange monster. It's spelled Monstar, capital M. And that means drew many to see him and drink of his ale. So again, he had the reputation. People were like, oh, you know, have you heard of the crazy barkeeper that, you know, runs that ale house under the bridge? So a part of the collection for the understanding of brewing, baking, making cider and mead, ordering, preserving all sorts of wines, cooking, preserved in Cambridge, probably dates from this time. Drebbel perhaps acquired in part of his knowledge of these matters from his brother-in-law, the brewer, Jacob Goltzius, during the time that he still lived in Holland. So even here, he was kind of an innovative guy when it came to like fermenting beer and brewing, and even just a creative guy in the kitchen. you know, just cooking and that kind of thing. And I mean, I'll later talk about, like, he invented certain aspects of stoves and ovens because of his control systems and measurement systems. So just anything he touched kind of turned to gold. Yeah. So after his death, in keeping with the traditional sort of Mennonite or, you know, Anabaptist practice, Drebbel's estate was split between his four living children at the time of his death. So, okay, that's the life of him. But now I really want to dive into his works here because it's just unbelievable some of the stuff that he did and really sets him apart in his time.
We mentioned that he would be, from an American standpoint, an Edison or a Franklin. Let's look at it in this sense, that he would be more of a Nikola Tesla or an Emmett Brown of his time.
What, like kind of a zany, a zany,
like,
inventor?
He's like, you know. In some ways, it's hard to compare him to others in his own time frame of the 17th century, for whose inventions were worked out later by others, especially after the foundation of the Royal Society of London. He was a brilliant empiric researcher and innovator. Drebbel's constructions and innovations cover, in particular, these following items: measurement and control technology. The Royal Society was later interested in his ovens and furnaces, which we'll talk about in a few moments. Pneumatics, optics, chemistry, hydraulics, and pyrotechnics.
Yeah, so with the Stadt in general, he registered several patents, which again just reminds me of Edison or someone of that nature. Now, the measurement and control systems, technology, pneumatics, whatever, however you want to categorize this. So first of all was the perpetual motion machine. But then we also have that he builds and navigates with a submarine. You can't kind of take these apart because even in a submarine, there were some control systems in place to keep the air fresh and you know, that kind of thing, and make sure that it was at the right depth. So he had a barometer to measure the depth and that kind of thing. He even built an incubator for eggs, which is interesting. And he built a portable stove oven with an optimal use of fuel. So it's really like this efficient portable oven that he kind of created. And he was able to keep the heat on a consistent temperature by means of, again, a regulator, sort of like a thermostat deal. So, you know, again, it's just like this self-controlling systems that he would build. And there was also designs for a solar energy system for London, which they called perpetual fire. And it demonstrates a sort of air conditioning aspect of it. And that this machine, I didn't read a whole lot about. I kind of skimmed through it, but it let it rain. It made lightning and thunder on command, quote unquote. And then, of course, he also developed these fountains, freshwater supply for the city of Middleburg, which I mentioned. And he was involved in the draining of the moors around Cambridge. So again, this hydraulics and these pumps and things. And he develops the predecessors of the barometer and the thermometer. Actually, I mean predecessors in the modern sense. He developed a barometer and a thermometer, period. There's the Drebelinsch instrument, which is harpsichords that play on solar energy. So that, like, it was basically solar heated water to some degree.
Boy, that sounds like Franklin. That sounds like
Benjamin
Franklin,
doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's just all these crazy things. So he was granted a patent in 1598 for a pump and clock with a perpetual motion. And so this was already pretty early on in his kind of career, and this kind of started his career as an inventor. This perpetual motion machine is really where he got his main reputation. The furnace that he created had similar principles of the perpetual motion machine, which he constructed. So when the fire began to burn too hot, the ashes got warm, and then the air in the retort expanded and pushed the quicksilver further up into the neck of the retort, which is, you know, that's a thermometer, right? And then by doing so, the quicksilver, like the mercury, would kind of trigger a damper to which a spring was attached, which closed down on the surface of the mercury so that as a result, less air was admitted than before, and the temperature of the fire and ashes would be reduced, okay? So fire gets hot, increases the volume of the mercury. The mercury, basically, long story short, the mercury pushes a damper, which lets in less air, which kind of makes the fire go down. So the fire would just, you can put all the fuel on you want, doesn't matter, and just enough air would get in automatically that it would stay the same temperature. This is super key for alchemists. You know, we talked about that before. You need a constant temperature for like 40 days at a time.
Yeah.
So forget about doing 8-hour shifts, 24 hours a day to, you know, make sure the air is not too hot or too cold. No, you throw in fire. You don't worry about it. Every couple hours you get up and you throw in more fuel. Everything else regulates itself. This is crazy. Like, it's insane.
So to get a little bit further into the details with his optics background, we talk about him developing an automatic precision lens grinding machine, builds upon improving the telescope's constructs of the first microscope that we talked about, and lens obscura, Laterna Magica, and manufactures Dutch or Batavian tears.
Yeah, and if he might be the first to create a really composite microscope consisting of two convex lenses. Maybe. I'm not sure about it. There were definitely microscopes before his time. And it's interesting. Like, I was looking up microscopes of that time period. And it's not like these little things that we put on a table like today. He got one from some Duke or somebody, I don't remember. But it's this big 4-foot brass tube that you put whatever you're looking up on the floor, and then you stand above it, and it's like, I don't know, 3 inches thick or something. And you know, everyone was remarking on how close up and how magnetized whatever you're looking at is. So it's kind of cool, but it's basically a telescope that you aim at the ground to look at small things. So, but yeah, I mean, it's neat stuff. So the perpetual motion machine, there was several built. There was the biggest one was for King James, and then he built a couple more smaller ones, but several for Rudolf II. And this was his big claim to fame, other than maybe the submarine. But the submarine almost expanded after his death, like the reputation for that. But in his lifetime, people were looking at this perpetual motion machine because everyone was like taking measurements on the holes and the tubes and the valves to kind of see if they can copy it. There was one in Belgium that he built, and people would like go up and really try to mimic it. But this was just like intuitive to him. So this ties into that control system thing that we talked about, and hydraulics and the pump and everything. So basically what it was, now a perpetual motion machine in its purest form cannot exist, because what you're doing is you create some machine, like some crazy complex machine involving magnets or this or that. And the point is that you touch something once and then it continues forever, right? That's the idea behind it. We now know that that's not possible. Isaac Newton had something to say about that. You know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction, which means you can't just touch something once and it goes on forever. It's physically impossible. But here's what he did. So it was basically solar powered. That's how you cheat, because with the heat of the sun, that will heat something up. And then when it cools, you know, then you refill your base, and then the sun heats it up again. But it's not a pure perpetual motion machine, because you are taking external energy, which is the solar energy, okay? But still, it was by far the closest and best that anybody had ever come up with at that time. And here's what it did. It kind of mimicked the ebb and flow of, like, the tides of the ocean. And basically, there was a metal disc in the middle, and you couldn't see the inner workings of it. And then there was a glass tube on the outside, kind of two half donuts shaped. You'd have water in the bottom, and then it would use the sun's heat up some part, and it had coils on the inside and springs. One of the one in Belgium broke, and as soon as it did, everyone like took it apart and was like looking at it and was like, you know, trying to reverse engineer it. And they could come close, but his was too perfect. It had to have it had some mercury involved in it for the barometer, and it had to have just the right hole. And then it was just basically an alchemical principles at the time, which is, you know, the heat evaporates, it expands the water and also the mercury, which expands the water more. And then as the water expands, the air would escape from one valve and go into the other chamber, where it would then kind of condense and go back into water. So in the warmest part of the day, the sun would heat it up enough that the water would flow. Like it would, you know, the tide would come in, basically. And then at night, towards the evening, the tide would go out. And also, you know, there was a kind of a circular aspect to it. So this was just magic to most people. Like, this was like mechanics at its purest form. No one could figure it out. People were like speculating on, does it need to be in a dry environment, a wet environment? Is there a reason why it is where it is in the one in Belgium? And yes, it had to have sunlight, you know, so there was a reason. But, and then, you know, when the sun would move, then it would go back into shadow and it would all kind of condense again. And so.
Well, at the beginning of this podcast tonight, Travis, we talked about the biographical sketch of Drebbel. And to understand his inventions, you have to understand the man. And the man himself was a man that felt that nature was a big player in all this. Is that correct?
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So by emulating what was going on with the tides, the coming in and going of the tides, making that a part of what he's doing with the perpetual motion machine, that makes sense to me. You know, he's not reinventing the wheel, so to speak.
Yeah.
He's using what he's seen in nature and trying to copy
it. His fountain in Middelburg also worked based on the tides, they think. It's really interesting. So the tide would come in, so the water table would rise, and that would create pressure against a chamber with fresh water in it. So this was like salt water coming in or whatever. That would create pressure for the fresh water, and the fresh water would shoot up through pipes, and that would be the fountain. And this had a higher water pressure than anybody's ever seen before at that point. And
Can I interject with this real quick? Because this seems to be an important question that I want to ask. The fountain wasn't just used for prettiness, was it? It was used for functionality. Most fountains in these times were meant for drinking.
But this one actually had pressure, and it was a
fountain. And put
in
fresh water so you can drink it. Mm-hmm. So to me, that you know, most of these things that you see, even from Roman times, fountains had a reason.
This was a big
for
deal.
Drinking
in fact,
water.
I wonder if it's still there. It would be 500 years old now, so probably not. But there is a fountain in Middelburg. I was just thinking about that when I was reading this. Like, wait a minute, is that fountain? I need to go back. But yeah, so it's really cool. And again, he's just using nature and, you know, creating these machines with it. He's also known for his chemistry, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't really be talking about him. One of his big contributions, and there's pages and pages on this, on the source that I read. He invented a much stronger red dye. It's like the famous scarlet dye. Yeah, there's kind of a legend here that goes along with it. So the story goes that while making a colored liquid for a thermometer, Cornelius dropped a flask of aqua regia, we talked about that before, it's an acid, on a tin windowsill and discovered that stannous chloride makes the color of carmine much brighter and more durable. Although Cornelius did not make much money from this, his daughters Anna and Katharina and his son-in-law Abraham and Johannes Sibertus Kuffler, again the Kufflers, set up a very successful dye works. And this is also funny. This is again like a Tesla story. So he creates all these inventions, other people make money off of it. Like later in life when he was poor, I'm like, he created the brightest red, you know, for, like cheap bright red, and he didn't make any money off of it. In any case, there was a big dye work set up in London, and the resulting color was this called bow dye. So if you've heard of that, that's Drebbler. And the recipe for color Kufflerianus was kept a family secret, and the new bright red color was very popular in Europe. Other people made tons of money off of his
invention. Can I ask you another question, if this is possibly true?
Yeah.
This would be the perfect time frame when the English armed forces were changing their coats from blue to red because of a cheaper dye issue. When we talk about the red coats of the 18th century, this is because they went for a cheaper dye. It wasn't because they wanted to stand out in warfare. It was because it was cheaper dye to make.
I skimmed over pages and pages of quotes about his dye, and it is kind of interesting in its own right. I mean, we mentioned on previous shows, what were the actual contributions of science from alchemists? Like, this is one, we talked about Prussian blue before.
Yeah.
Now we have blue, we have red. And these are, you know, kind of, and this is really interesting because it was really cheap ingredients for the most part. It was like some tin alloy and some other things. And there's one ingredient from the States which made the best, that's an interesting side note, that made the best, the deepest red. But yeah, so that's something that was a major contribution, although he didn't really profit off of it. Other chemistry innovations were, besides the dye, he developed a method to regain silver ore. And then he also probably isolated oxygen for his submarine, which I'll come back to in detail, because that's crazy interesting also. When we talked about the pumps that he made, he also used hydraulics to make like theater props, moving statues. You know, so things that would kind of seem like magic to some people. And he was also involved in plans for a new theater in London, because this was, you know, that would kind of match his props and his way of the stage, basically.
One of the dimensions we really focused on was his pyrotechnic work, and which enhances and produces torpedoes and sea mines, and a detonator with Batavian tears used fulminating mercury, aurum fulminarum, as an explosive.
There was, again, like pages and pages on this in that source. Really interesting stuff. So here's kind of a pacifist. I thought this was weird because he actually lobbied for this to be used by the Navy, some applications for this, and they didn't really take to it. So this was his falling out with the Admiralty later in life. And I don't know the reasons why. So he had all kinds of inventions for, like, you know, using better cannons, and then, like, torpedoes and sea mines, right? So he had a gunpowder that would burn underwater. This guy's science fiction, if you're talking 17th century. Because to go with his submarine, so first he had the submarine, and then he's like, okay, but you could use these as war machines in this way, and then you could also have exploding things that are projectiles. That's a torpedo. None of them were really used, as far as I can tell, so I kind of left some of it out. But again, it's just to show that he was a very innovative guy and probably had more potential than the people around him realized in some ways. But he did work with the Navy, the British Navy, and all that. Yeah, if you want to look up some of his works, there are some that still survive today. There's one that was written in Dutch originally, but it's a short treatise of the nature of elements, and it was translated into German and Latin and all that. And he was involved in the invention of mercury fulminate, which we just mentioned. This is like a super alchemical thing. So he found out that mixtures of spiritus vini with mercury and silver in aqua fortis could explode. So that's just, you know, some alchemical language right there. But let's get into the submarine, because this is the fact of the podcast right here. This is what's just unbelievable about his lifetime. So I think you can still see a replica of his submarine in London. So he's probably much more known. He's probably much more well known in London than outside of, because you see this 17th century replica of a submarine. You know, you start asking questions. So this was, again, while he was working for the English Royal Navy, he built the first navigable submarine in 1620. And he was, again, standing on the shoulders of giants, because there was William Bourne's design in 1578, which he kind of designed a steerable submarine, but it was never built. So between 1620 and 1624, Drebbel successfully built and tested two more submarines, each one bigger than the last. And the third, the final one, had six oars and could carry 16 passengers. Now, this model was demonstrated to King James I in person, and several thousand Londoners, so it was quite this spectacle. And the submarine stayed submerged for 3 hours, and there's some quotes later on about this. It's kind of interesting. Like, everyone thought they were dead, because 3 hours is...
Yeah.
Everyone just thought they were dead. They started going home, you know? And so it could travel from Westminster to Greenwich and back, and it could cruise at about a depth of, like, 12 to 15 feet, 4 to 5 meters. And supposedly, Drebbel even took James in his submarine on a test dive beneath the Thames, making James I the first monarch to travel underwater.
Wow.
How do you like that? Them cool. Apples, yeah. However, the Admiralty just never really got on board with this, which I can't figure it out, because maybe they said, well, what do we do with 3 hours or 15 feet? Mm. No, if you advance that technology, you know, and Drebbel even wrote, like, well, you go into an enemy port and you just attach explosives to the... I mean, what do you mean? So let me explain. I think I can kind of understand some of the skepticism. And this was because even what I just said, like all these stories, especially the quotes that we're about to read, are probably exaggerations. So some historians believe that really it was at most semi-submersible. I don't believe this. I think it went underwater from reading some of the descriptions. I think it was completely submersible, but that it was only able to travel down the Thames by force of the current. Which could be. It did have oars, and the oars were attached to the inside by leather. And also, to be clear, we're not really talking about a submarine. It had an open bottom, which was more like a sailable diving bell,
yeah.
Right? So it doesn't matter. I do believe it was completely submersible, which means at that point, you know, you're invisible. You go into enemy harbors. There was some of the quotes said, like, you know, they could weather a storm and, you know, like nothing was there. Here's one quote we have, and this is during his lifetime. So I guess I'd give these a little bit more weight, even though some of these are clearly exaggerated. The later ones are even more exaggerated. So, but here, Faba, a German savant living in Italy in 1625, he's kind of known in his own right. He says, quote, "Persons who have sailed under the sea in that ship invented by the remarkable genius of a Dutchman, Cornelius Drebbel, and constructed in London, England, where it may be seen even today," well, at that time
it's 1625.
Yeah. There's a replica now, so you can kind of see it. "Have sworn me solemnly," again, so this is a friend of a friend told me that, "but have sworn to me solemnly that while a storm was raging on the surface, deep down in the sea, they experienced not the slightest difficulty. The ship carries 24 people," again, that's an exaggeration, "8 of them row, while the rest remain in their little cubicles. For 24 hours, they suffer no lack of air and live contentedly on that which is locked in the little vessel. After this period of time has elapsed, they go up to the surface of the sea, and when the cover of the boat has been unbolted and left open for a short time, they take in fresh air, upon which they are able, after putting the lid on the ship again, to dive down as deep into the water as the captain wishes to do." No, not true. "Even to the depth of 50 fathoms, should he so desire. And what will surprise you still more, they steer by the compass and know where they are, and they move the ship with the greatest ease by means of oars. But what almost passes belief is this, that part of the ship where the rowers sit has no bottom, so that the water is visible all the time to these rowers, who are nevertheless not in the least afraid, as sitting on their seats a little above the water, they never touch it with their feet." So again, it's more like a diving bell than a true submarine, but regardless, that's pretty impressive. And then Constantine Huygens writes in his autobiography in 1631, "Worth all the rest put together is the little ship in which he calmly dived under the water while he kept the king and several thousand Londoners in the greatest suspense. The great majority of these already thought that the man who had very cleverly remained invisible to them for 3 hours, as rumor has it, had perished, when he suddenly rose to the surface a considerable distance from where he had dived down, bringing with him the several companions of his dangerous adventure to witness to the fact they had experienced no trouble or fear under the water, but had sat on the bottom when they so desired, and had ascended when they wished to do so, that they had sailed whithersoever they had in mind, rising as much near to the surface or again diving as much deeper as it pleased them to do so, without even being deprived of light. Yea, even that they had done in the belly of that whale all the things people are used to do in the air, and this without any trouble. From all this, it is not even hard to imagine what would be the usefulness of this bold invention in time of war. If in this manner, a thing which I have repeatedly heard Drebbel assert, enemy ships lying safely at anchor could be secretly attacked and sunk unexpectedly by means of a battering ram, an instrument of which hideous use is made nowadays in the capturing of the gates and bridges of towns." All right, so then in 1645, this is after his death, we find Cornelis van der Woude of Alkmaar telling the following story. "He made a ship with which one could row underwater and sail from Westminster to Greenwich, a distance of 2 Dutch miles. Yes, even 5 or 6 miles, as far as one wished. And in the ship it is possible to see without a candle, and to read the Bible, or any other book, which ship was to be seen lying in the Thames, London's river, until a few years ago. If you want to read a Bible underwater, there you go. Drebbel's your man." Now the cool part is that Drebbel determined the depth to which his boat had descended by means of a quicksilver barometer, like a mercury barometer. The depth that this could reach is clearly exaggerated all the time because they just didn't know how much water pressure there really was very quickly as soon as you go down. Again, there were divers and there was diving bells and that kind of thing, but I think they really underestimated that if you go below like 15 feet even, you know, like let's say 5 meters, that the water pressure is so much that the oars don't help anymore. There's no getting out of it. Once you reach a very shallow distance, there's no getting back to the surface.
Time writes in 1612, in his little work on perpetual motion, that the bolt in the perpetuum mobile was filled with a fiery spirit extracted out of the mineral matter. This expression suggests a preparation of oxygen from saltpeter.
Yeah, so this is interesting because there's a lot of speculation. Yeah, there's a couple quotes about this, but basically the gist is this, that there's a lot of speculation that he was able to isolate oxygen in some way that he could release it into a submarine. So
just when he thought the air was getting too stale.
Yeah. So right? When the air was starting to get bad, he could just open this little flask and refresh the air in the submarine. Now, again, how much of this is exaggeration, I don't know. But it did give the inspiration later. There's a quote here from Robert Boyle that the Royal Society of England like grasped onto this and said, hey, Drebbel did it. It's possible. Let's figure this out. Yeah, Kepler said something about it. But so it's just interesting that is one thing he kept a secret, supposedly, and took with him to his grave, which means it might have not happened at all.
Right.
But still, like, the idea that that's how his... So first of all, as these submarine stories were embellished, we just heard one that they said he could stay underwater for 24 hours. Not true.
No.
But even if you had a little bit of extra oxygen, not true. And then you just open the hatch and then it's all good again. That wouldn't be true because you'd need to refill your oxygen thing.
At this point, there's no filters in there. And basically what you're breathing out, carbon dioxide, would overpower any kind of amount of tubes that you would have to bring in more oxygen to balance it out. These are problems that
you could add oxygen to it, but no.
Yeah, these are the problems that the diesel submariners were having during World War I.
Mm-hmm.
All right, remember, I mean, they had to submerge quite a bit before they would go into attack mode because they didn't have the oxygen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it is interesting that even if he didn't really do it, he had the reputation of having done it, which created inspiration for later people to actually isolate oxygen.
Kepler, one of our favorite folks we've talked about before, also heard and wrote of this in 1607. If he can create a new spirit, Kepler says, by means of which he can move and keep in motion his instrument without weights or propelling power, he will then be Apollo, in my opinion.
Yeah, and this was specifically about, he didn't say oxygen, but he's talking about, you know, creating the air that is the air of life.
Basically. And basically call him godlike.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Pretty good words from Kepler.
Yeah, and so Robert Boyle, this is 1627 to 1691. So he's, you know, the whole Royal Society and all that thing. So he says, and this is taken from parts of his quote, basically, quote, that this is not the whole body of the air, but a certain quintessence, as chemists speak, chemists with a Y, or spirituous part of it, that makes it fit for respiration, which being spent, the remaining grosser body or carcass, if I may so call it, yeah, he may, of the air is unable to cherish the vital flame residing in the heart. Okay. so that for aught I could gather, besides the mechanical contrivance of his vessel, he had a chemical liquor, which he accounted the chief secret of his submarine navigation. For when, from time to time, he perceived that the finer and purer part of the air was consumed or overclogged by the respiration and steams of those that went in his ship. Steams? Ugh. Sorry. Yeah. He would, by unstopping a vessel full of this liquor, speedily restore the troubled air such a proportion of vital parts as would make it again, for a good while, fit for respiration, whether by dissipating or precipitating the grosser exhalations or by some other intelligible way. Having made it my business to learn what this strange liquor may be, they constantly affirmed me that Drebbel would never disclose the liquor to any, nor so much as tell the matter whereof he made it, to above one person, who himself assured me what it was. So here we say, Boyle is like, Drebbel didn't tell anybody, didn't tell a single soul, but he told one guy, and that guy told me. And so here I'm gonna do it now. There's another like related quote in the minutes of the Royal Society, where in the minutes of they're dated May 6th, 1669, quote, Mr. Daniel Cox mentioned that Cornelius Drebbel pretended to have a certain liquor to supply the want of fresh air in the boat, which he had made to go underwater with, end quote. So again, like whether he had something or didn't have something, the reputation was that he did, and therefore the Royal Society was going to damn well figure out what it is. So, and oxygen was isolated not that long after. So it's pretty interesting stuff.
So, yeah, as we're wrapping up the program tonight, let's look at some of the honors that are bestowed upon him. For one, there's a small lunar crater that has been named after him on the moon. Cornelius Drebbel also has been honored on a postage stamp issued by the Postal Service of both both Mali and of the Netherlands in 2010. The betrayal of Cornelius Drebbel and his submarine can also briefly be seen in The Four Musketeers from 1974, that film. A small leather-clad submersible surfaces off the coast of England, and the top opens in a clamshell-wise revealing Cornelius Drebbel and the Duke of Buckingham.
Yeah.
All right, so maybe I should go see that. It's a 1974 movie, yeah. But maybe it works. Drebbel is also honored with an episode of the cartoon C-Lab 2021. I actually enjoyed that. That was about 10 years ago that was on, wasn't it? During a submarine rescue of workers in a research station in the Arctic. A German U-boat captain fired a pistol in celebration at that mention of Drebbel, of shouts of, Sieg Heil, Cornelius Drebbel.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Also on C-Lab 2021, Season 3 DVD, Cornelius Drebbel has two DVDs commemorating, devoted to his life. So, yeah, pretty interesting if you watch that show. I think it was on the Comedy Central or...
Okay, yeah, sounds right.
Or Cartoon Network.
Okay, yeah,
it's on
Cartoon
Network back in the States. In the Dutch 80 Years War comic, Jill de Goo... Drebbel is a, and I'm sorry if that, I have to say, I don't know if that's the right pronunciation.
Jules de Goo?
Yeah, Jules de Goo. Drebbel is supporting a character to the war hero, Giel. He is drawn as a crazy inventor, similar to Q in the James Bond series. His submarine plays a role in that comic as well.
Yeah, here's another one that we've mentioned over and over on the show. A special manuscript known as the Voynich Manuscript. We've mentioned it several times, I'm not gonna repeat what it is, but Richard Santa Coloma has speculated that the Voynich manuscript may be connected to Drebbel, initially suggesting it was Drebbel's cipher notebook on microscopy and alchemy. There's a later hypothesizing that it was the fictional tie-in to Francis Bacon, which we talked about Francis Bacon's connection and all that. But again, in Francis Bacon's utopian novel New Atlantis, there's some Drebbel-related items like a submarine, a perpetual clock, that are said to appear. So, there's a connection there. It wouldn't be a proper alchemy podcast if we don't mention the Voynich manuscript. So this was a really interesting read. I loved researching this guy. I learned a lot. This guy really is kind of the Emmett Brown of innovators here. And thank you very much, Steve C., again, for sending that in. Again, there's another show we have recorded I'm about to publish from another listener. And I really appreciate this because... I have a long list of alchemists I want to talk about, but if someone points me in the right direction and say, this guy should be the top of your list, then I'll listen. And in this case, absolutely, this is much appreciated. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.